This podcast is sponsored by Low No Drinker magazine, the number one UK magazine for the sober, curious drinker, bringing you news, reviews and interviews from the people, places and brands leading the low and no alcohol revolution. As a Sober Rebel listener, use code SOBERREBEL15 to get 15% off any digital or print subscription from the Low No Drinker magazine for 6 whole months. Hello and welcome to the Sober Rebel podcast. I'm Louisa Evans, and I talk to my guests about the joys of sobriety and the benefits that it's brought them. We talk a bit about their story and how they got sober, but we also talk about why they enjoy staying sober. And today I am so privileged to be able to talk to a lady that I've been following since day one. Yes, another one. I followed her story, I scrolled back through her timeline, and I can't wait for you all to meet her. So here she is, here's Carmela. So just thank you so much for joining me.
No,
I have been, like we were saying, I've been sober stalking you since day one.
I'll take that as a compliment and a very welcome stalking.
Share whatever you'd like to share about your sobriety, why you went sober, how long you've been sober. Over to you.
Okay, so I'm Carmela, I'm 41, mother of one. In my, you know, normal life, I'm an event director, so it keeps me very busy. And I'm about just over 3.5 years sober, I believe, now. It's crazy.
Wow.
You start from counting the days and then you're actually trying to remember the months. It's incredible just how fast you kind of get to that point where it becomes a way of life, where it has for me. And yeah, a little bit about my story. It's an interesting one because there was no rock bottom moment, but there was many rock bottom moments over the years and definitely points of where I really should have really took a good hard look at my relationship with alcohol years before I actually did. But yeah, I was a party girl through my late teens and 20s. And I'm going to be honest, you know, I've had some incredible times drinking, you know, but also when you look back, it's less about the drinking and actual fact that period of my life and the excitement. And I just think social scenes were very different to what they are now. You know, you could go out 4 or 5 nights a week and everywhere would be rammed. And I really thrived off that buzz and that connection and the getting up ready and the music. And actually, when I sort of really think back, even though I did drink during those periods, it was less about the drink and more about the vibe and the fun and the excitement. But what's really interesting about alcohol is it's not like a linear sort of path that we take. It's not like one day you're absolutely drinking fine and then literally the following week you've got an issue with alcohol. It's actually this slow, long creep. And it's a slow, long creep that morphs and changes, you know, as our lives change, the way we interact with alcohol often changes. Just to kind of give an example is, you know, the way that I was drinking in my 20s was very different to the way I started drinking when I got into serious relationships, because out goes, you know, the going out, going to clubs and bars and drinking on a social scene to cozy dinners where you open a bottle of wine. And actually what would become, was, you know, historically drinking outside of the home comes into the home.
Yeah.
And then from there, motherhood comes along. And for many of us, we do find ourselves very lost, very confused, very lonely. Add in, you know, if anyone has, you know, like I did, it's, you know, issues with postnatal depression and tricky births, and alcohol actually becomes something very different again. And it definitely did for me. But yeah, for a long time, I knew that alcohol was not serving me. There's a history of alcohol abuse in my family. I've watched relatives die very young, actually, in their 40s. And it's crazy, isn't it, how you can witness all that and, you know, experience growing up with side effects of like influential people, family members who have addiction issues with alcohol, but yet can find yourself in a similar position. And it's like, how does that happen?
It's like you disassociate, don't you, really?
You do.
You sort of think, well, that's not how I'm drinking, or you can...
You've hit the
paint
nail
a different, yeah, paint a different story, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we benchmark. We all have these ideas of what, let's say, an alcoholic looks like, you know, and often they're images that are portrayed in the media and what we see on TV, you know, it was usually a man for some reason.
Yeah.
Park bench, brown paper bag, or Phil Mitchell's drinking issues portrayed in EastEnders. I don't think actually in the reality, many people can relate to that, but yet it's still this image we have in our minds. And again, you know, for me, I had a benchmark on what someone or what people with alcohol problems looked like and how they interacted and how they drank. And mine wasn't the same. You know, I wasn't hiding it. I was out socializing. I wasn't drinking in the early hours of the day unless I was going on a flight.
Yeah, or it was your birthday
5 in the
or
morning.
Christmas or, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think... for a long time, I knew I had a tricky relationship with alcohol. And the way I identified that was I'd experienced a lot of blackouts and I would find out that I would have done things which I had zero recollection of and just would never, ever dream of behaving if alcohol hadn't been in the equation. And I just knew that I had poor mental health, you know, actually from my late teens, you know, I suffered with eating disorders and depression. And I felt that alcohol was having a kind of impact in that too. I didn't really take any great steps to address it until a friend, and this is nothing related to alcohol, which is the ironic thing. A friend of mine, she got diagnosed with breast cancer very young. She had 4 children, but this girl was like literally the life and soul and absolutely stunning. And you just think, oh, how unfair that she should be, you know, having to deal with something like cancer. And she, you know, really made it her work to start educating people about cancer and her journey. And actually, you know, a lot of it can be due to lifestyle factors. You know, those sorts of messages really struck home with me.
Yeah.
Got a big fear of dying, had a very small child at the time. And it kind of got me looking at my health in general, not necessarily just the alcohol. And over the next couple of years, I did actually start really taking this on board and being thinking like, okay, what can I start improving? And alcohol kept cropping up as something that, you know, I kept hearing in my inner voice that I needed to address. Yeah, over that time, I started to try and get some significant times of not drinking under my belt. I'd manage a week or I might manage 2 weeks. And I will say I didn't drink all the time, but when you are actively setting yourself targets of not drinking for a sustained period of time, it's bloody tough because you all of a sudden have like works drinks or an event or birthday. And actually you realize that the way that you interact with alcohol, it's not as simple as I'm just going to take a couple of weeks off, because even though you might be able to do it and not have any physical reactions to it, things happen in life that make it really, really difficult to maintain, you know, those long stretches of sobriety. But I did, and I was kind of doing little stints here and there and built up to just under 100 days. Yeah, but I never could quite get it to stick. And then I'd gone on this period of, you know, this stopping and starting, trying to get more time under my belt. But I think I was aiming for moderation still at this point.
Yeah.
Trying to control my drinking. Reality is, if I could control my drinking, I'd already been done it. It was the pandemic. And the beginning of the pandemic, my drinking ramped up massively, you know, because we're all in it together. Life's so shit, so we're going to have, you know, wine. And actually, I was noticing that I was starting to drink earlier and earlier, just because you could feel like you're on holiday, that kind of mentality. Very, very strange times. And I remember we were just coming out, I'm pretty sure it was just coming out of the first lockdown. And I remember, beautiful day, me and a friend met up and we said, let's go for a walk. And we walked past the pub in the village and we were like, let's just go for a drink in the beer garden because it's such a beautiful day. And you know, we had some drinks and nothing significant happened, but I don't remember getting home. And that was actually the point where I woke up and went, I'm done. I'm just done. That was it. There was no rock bottom, but there was that straw that broke the camel's back. And I was just like, I'm just done. I need to just nail this. I need to just, you know, really draw a line in the sand. And this is really what I want. And that's kind of, I guess the story that took me up to sobriety, really.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? You don't realise how much it permeates. Like you were saying, you set yourself an idea of, oh, I'll just take this fortnight off or this month off. I never managed that.
No.
There was always a birthday or a holiday or a break or a Tuesday. And so what then? How did you tackle it from that day on? What did you do?
So it's interesting, isn't it? Because people would often look at my Instagram and think that what they're seeing on my Instagram is my journey of sobriety. In actual fact, you're missing years of my journey to sobriety. We often say start before you're ready. And there is a reason for that, because I don't know anyone that's completely woken up one day and gone, I'm going to try going sober and just nailing it, you know, who had kind of an ingrained issue with alcohol. You know, there are obviously always exceptions to the rules, but it's definitely not the norm for many. When you're looking at my kind of journey, I'd done stints. And what I did, I started really pulling on the knowledge that I had been picking up along the way, but not really understood how to implement it or wasn't ready to implement it. So reading that I had done, I knew that that was working. I'd also stumbled across Instagram and sobriety accounts before I set up this account. God knows how. No one knows how they stumble across sober Instagram, but then you find it and it's like, oh, wow, there's people that look normal and they're not drinking and they're going out and they're really smashing life. And it was really, really inspiring to kind of bring it all back round to that day when I woke up and I hadn't remembered the night before and nothing had significantly happened, but I didn't. It was yet another blackout, yet another night of, you know, just intending to go out for one or two and not being able to moderate. I was like, right, okay, so what do I need to do? And the first thing I did was set up my sober account. And the reason I'd set up that sober account is because I really felt that I needed accountability. I'd seen it working for other people and I was really inspired by that. But the problem was, I was really not ready to tell anyone that I was doing this. And the reason is because I'd cried wolf far too many times. I'd woken up with remorse thousands of times and no one believed that I was going to change. You know, it was so ingrained in, I guess, how people saw me and my persona and the party girl, social butterfly idea that people are like, you ain't going to, you've said this before, you're not going to crack it. So I actually set my account up and I only followed other sobriety accounts. I really knew I needed to immerse myself. And I did that, but then I actually went through, it took quite a while, I blocked everyone that I knew so they couldn't find me. And I'd created this comfort blanket for myself to allow me the time and the space to explore what this journey is actually going to mean to me. Genuinely, I look back and I have so many tools that I implement every day and that I've learned in sobriety, but actually I use for other areas of my life now because they are adaptable and they do work in other areas. But this sober Instagram account, creating a situation which is, you know, where you're literally immersing yourself, you're educating yourself, you're feeding yourself, you're inspiring yourself. It is the biggest tool, hands down.
Yeah.
And you know, for anyone that doesn't know my journey, you know, the way I got sober was myself. And I never went to AA, GP. You know, I had had conversations where, you know, during the pandemic, my mental health had taken a massive nosedive and had some frank conversations. But it was, you know, try and cut down. try and exercise, try and meditate. And it is great advice if you're in a position to be able to implement that advice on your own. Yeah, I just wasn't there. So Sober Instagram was my support mechanism.
Sober Instagram was my route. And this morning at 4 o'clock when I woke up, I was going back through your account because I like to have a little look at who I'm chatting to. And I do remember looking back and I scrolled right back to the start of your account. And I remember looking, thinking, because you actually did start day one and you've left all the posts up there, haven't you?
I have. And because my account has morphed and evolved, you know, it generally is my diary. But whilst it's my way of life, it was actually someone who, you know, I met through Sober Instagram. You know, he said to me, because my account was private, right? And, you know, and it was very locked down. And he said, I think that if you told your story, it would really help people. And I was like, ooh. You know, don't want to tell my story. But then something inside me said, you know what, as much as I feel uncomfortable, I'm getting inspiration by someone putting themselves out there and being vulnerable. So actually, I should do that, because the rawness and experience you can share, and I will say this to anyone who's early on in their sobriety and maybe looking at my account and thinking you've got nothing to impart, you're in it. You're living it. You are learning as you go. And by sharing that, it's there. It's there as you're learning. It's there as you're experiencing it. And that is golden to other people that are in your situation. Because actually, me, so far into my sobriety, it's quite hard to take yourself back there into those granular details sometimes. So, yeah, you know, if that's anyone listening to this, you know, please just share. Be vulnerable, because your vulnerability is actually going to be someone's saviour. So, you know, definitely.
Yeah. And well, I watched you in my kitchen. And so if you hadn't have put your account public, then and it is, isn't it? You just find those people that you think, oh, now I resonate with that person, or I recognise myself in that person, because you read some books and some stories and you think that isn't quite where I was.
And I hear you. I really hear you. And what I will say is there is no right or wrong way in sobriety, right?
Exactly.
Just as you're not going to like everyone in real life just because someone's sober, don't mean you have to like them. Just because someone's sober doesn't mean you have to find them inspiring. Quite the opposite, right? We're all humans. And that, I have to say, the way that social media is growing and evolving, it is giving us options. It's giving us avenues, because I don't know whether this is the same with you, but I am feeling it now of how lonely I was. I felt so lonely. I wasn't that family member who was bad enough to go to rehab and get proper treatment. But I, you know, when you speak to health professionals, I wasn't that bad. So where do you go?
Yeah.
I was in this no man's land of, you know, benchmarking myself against my peers. And actually, I would say that even I was drinking less than a lot of people that I know. You can't Google, am I an alcoholic, and get a definitive answer. And it leaves lots of thoughts of, am I bad enough? Should I be trying to stop drinking? Should I be trying to moderate my drink? Or is it all in my head? Is it just me that is hearing this voice saying I'm drinking too much, because I'm looking around me and no one else is hearing it? So what's wrong with me? It becomes all on you. It becomes this negative self-talk, and it affects other areas of your life too, because you feel like a failure. You feel like a failure because you're not being able to drink and handle life like your peers. You're thinking there's something wrong with you, but even the doctors aren't giving you that definitive answer of, yes, you need to do this. You're in this no man's land. It's the most horrible, vulnerable place that you can be. But until you realise and have the conversations and realise that actually there are so many people that are feeling exactly like you, do you go, okay, it's not me. Maybe it actually is alcohol.
Yeah, that was the biggest realisation for me, was literally sitting there and going, oh, it's a drug. Oh, why have I not realised that before? Oh, it's highly addictive. Okay, well, that makes more sense now as to why I was struggling to moderate.
I'm going to be quite frank here. It's interesting, isn't it, how we view alcohol? Because even though I know alcohol is a drug and it ruins lives and everything. I often get pulled into these funny debates, and usually on LinkedIn, so it's nothing sort of in the sober circle, but it's usually the debates around, well, are you saying that alcohol should be banned? And I find myself going, well, no, because I'm pro-choice. But I wonder, why am I being like that? Why am I still giving alcohol a get out of jail free card? But I do believe in choice. I will say that, you know, I think that if something's ripped away from you, you're going to want it more. Yeah. I think that, you know, when you're looking to change your relationship with anything, I don't think prohibition works. Look at history, it didn't. Re-education, though, because if you looked at, let's say, cigarettes, for example, had we have just ripped cigarettes away from the smokers, there would have been uproar. But it's been phased out. And how many smokers do you know now?
Yeah. And nobody's under any illusion, are they, that it's good for them, or that it's, you know, any of the messages that were being sort of said in the 1920s and 1930s.
And we look at it and we go, oh, God, look, someone's still smoking and they, you know, haven't they, like, do they not read? Do they not know? You know, why are they still doing it? And it's almost like they're frowned upon and judged. But I want to sort of say, you know, looking at smoking, and yes, smoking has direct link to cancer. So does alcohol. But many more types of cancers than smoking. And then we don't look at all the other areas of which, you know, alcohol impacts in a negative way. Hospital admissions, and we're just talking from drunk night out, okay? We're talking about domestic violence. We're talking about burglary. We're talking about drink driving. All these crazy things that you would never have experienced by smoking a cigarette. And yet smoking has been phase out. It's interesting, isn't it, really?
I think it's going to be very interesting in the next 10, 15, maybe 20 years, what happens with alcohol. I sense a shift.
I think there's going to be a shift in the way that we as consumers decide whether we're going to consume alcohol or not. I don't think it's going to be a government-led initiative. I think it brings too much money to the economy. I think it's a great way of repressing us. I do. And that's woo. But that's what it is. Alcohol is a downer. But I'm not an expert on all this. But yeah, I don't think it's going anywhere.
Well, you're an expert by experience, aren't you? I think that's the thing, is that we all experience the marketing and the kind of pushing. And I would sort of try and err on the side of, I don't want alcohol bash, but bloody hell, doesn't it need it? I don't know if you still get fading effect bias at 3.5 years in. Are you quite resolute, or just sometimes that romanticized idea creep back in for you?
No, not through the marketing. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And actually, and I think a big reason why that isn't romanticized for me is because I still go to bars regularly. I still I'm in those areas, but I have a glamorous cocktail. Do you know what I mean? It's not like that life is off limits for me. It's just the alcohol that's off limits for me. I did find myself in an interesting situation the other weekend of actually when I felt really triggered to drink. Now, there's nothing in me that would ever make me drink. And when people say, is this forever? For me, I personally think, well, she got away for something, so I'm aiming for forever. That's not helpful for everyone, but it is for me.
You're the first person that said that, and that makes me feel really good. I really love that idea.
You know what I mean? You've got to set your flag somewhere, right?
Right, I'm setting mine up forever then with you.
Why not? That's empowering to me. Whatever works for you. But, you know, I like to think that I've done enough work for me to realise and to set my life up in such a way that what the fuck could alcohol bring me? Now, I'll tell you what it could bring me, and I'll bring back round to that example of where I'm in a social situation with people, I'm meeting new people, and I'm out with a friend and everyone is drinking. And I just was kind of... with me, if the magic ingredients aren't there, and if I'm not super, should we say, motivated by the night out, not to say that where I was, there was anything wrong with it, but I probably could have sort of ended my night a little bit earlier. where everyone was drinking and I was so not on the same wavelength, and I was kind of just struggling with, because I get nervous meeting new people. I love it, but I can find it quite draining, especially when there's a lot of new people that I have to kind of get around the room and network. It's different if I'm working, though, but that's just a very
different mindset.
I'm very good at sort of putting on a different sort of persona. But where everyone's so, you know, they're drinking loads and they're loosening up, and I wasn't able to do that. And I kind of find myself getting a bit tetchy with my friend, because she's getting limber, she's having a drink. And I feel like, I just kind of feel like I'm being in mum mode. But I can acknowledge that alcohol would have given me a little bit of relief in that moment. And sometimes it is lovely to feel that. And it's fine to acknowledge it, but it's whether you feel the need to act upon it. Because you have to weigh up, what is that going to give me beyond that moment of where I'm in a bar with some people that I will see again, and I will be in that bar again, and this isn't my last night on earth. What are the consequences of that one drink for me? You know, people say to me all the time, couldn't you just have one? Yeah, I could have just one, but that opens the door for me. And yes, I could moderate, but it doesn't mean that in my mind I'm moderating along with, you know, the outward appearance of moderating. I've got this internal conflict going inside. I'd be looking for the next drink. I wouldn't be giving two shits about what you're doing. I would be solely focused on this weird little internalization around alcohol. And I know that's just, I don't want to live like that. I want to engage. I want to interact with people. I don't want to be living in this world which I'm creating and which alcohol is kind of enabling. Some of the reasons why I found myself drinking to excess sometimes without even realizing it, and it's an observation I've definitely put my finger on now I'm sober. If that I'm on a night out, and we've all been there, and you're kind of glammed up and you want some good music and you want some people to talk to and you just want the right vibe, you find yourself out, there's no one interesting around, the music's shit, there's no one out, and you're finding yourself kind of in that place where the magic ingredients aren't there. So what do? You have a drink and you kind of limber up a little bit, and then you have another drink and another drink, and before you know it, you're in exactly the same situation, in the same shitty bar where there's no people, the music's crap, but you've took yourself into this alternative reality that alcohol is creating, right? So you're in your own little world, everything's hazy, you become less and less aware of your surroundings, and you think you're having a good night.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, when you strip it all back, the only thing that has made it a good night is the alcohol and that alternative reality that you've created for yourself, and it isn't the night out. When you're sober, what you realize is that if the magic ingredients ain't there, that's fine. You're off. You know what I mean? You don't feel the need to stay in that shitty bar with the boring people, with the rubbish music. You're like, okay, I'm quite happy to call it a night. I've had a couple of, you know, I've seen my friend, had a catch up, spent a couple of hours together. I'm kind of quite happy to then go home, because I know that I actually have got lots of things happening the next day that is going to bring me joy, and I'm not living for that moment.
It's almost like you're lowering your expectations to the shitty bar and the dodgy music and the no friends. You're lowering those expectations down by drinking the same thing that's dumbing you down.
Absolutely.
Rather than going, this situation is just not where I want to be. It's not the right vibe for me.
Yeah. So you stay out for all this extra time. You waste time
and money
in something that's not fair anymore.
So I asked my guests on here to talk about three areas of their life that have changed in sobriety. What's your first area that you'd say?
Well, I did say this to you, I'm probably less of a dickhead.
I'm so pleased you included that. Yeah. I think we could all hold our hands up to that one.
What I mean by that is I'm still a dickhead, but probably less of a liability for sure. And I know that sounds really silly, but it is quite a nice feeling to feel like a responsible human being that can actually remember how they got home and not have to have people worrying about them all the time and not being so hungover that actually your life and your, you know, your prioritizing alcohol over all things is impacting everyone. It impacts, you know, your partner. It impacts my son. You know, the amount of times I'd come home after a big night out and I'd be so unwell. And it's like your child, who is tiny, is sitting next to you on the iPad. You can't get those moments back. And it is something that I still really, really struggle with, you know, my impact on other people. Because that is all down to me. And I bet it wasn't me in many respects, because I don't recognize the person that can't even remember a night to make a decision for themselves. You know, it's very hard coming to terms with genuinely not knowing what you're doing when you've been drinking, because I would black out all the time. And I know that's not a similar experience for everyone else, but when you hear people say the way that you can act at times, it's so alien, it's frightening, because you can't see it, you can't benchmark it, and when you hear it, you don't recognize it. And that's a horrible thing to have to kind of live with and to think about the situations that you've potentially put yourself in. It's something that I try very hard to make peace with, but I'm going to be honest, I don't think I'll ever make peace with it entirely. But I can give myself grace. So yeah, being less of a liability and less of a dickhead, but still a bit of a dickhead, is definitely a big change for me.
Still got that little bit there.
We all do, don't we?
So when you talk about blackouts then, because I know that a lot of people will think of that and they'll think of blacking out, passing out, but that isn't the case at all, is it? So would that just happen to you after a few drinks?
Oh, guaranteed. So this is another thing when we talk about moderation. My version of moderation or moderate drinking would be if I could not black out. Think about that for a moment. Mm. And actually, when I do speak to people, they kind of get on board with that. Because actually, when we're talking about moderation and we're talking about, you know, less than two drinks spread out over three or more days, is that really what anyone wants to, you know, to achieve? No, they want to be able to drink what they want, when they want, without any negative consequences. Yeah, for me, I mean, how sad that my benchmark of moderation was whether I could actually get home in one piece and remember the night. That's my truth. It's not going to be the same for everyone. But when we're talking about blackouts, the way people would say is that for me, I could be drink, absolutely fine. And then it was like a switch. And the only way to describe it, it's like speaking to a zombie. Something would go. They said you could always see in your eyes and you would just go, you weren't there. You were there, you weren't there.
Mm.
And that could carry on for hours. And then if I carried on drinking, at some point, yes, it would be blackout, passed out. But it was this whole period of zombie Carmella.
That's so scary, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, to most people, they're just thinking they're speaking to someone semi-pissed, but I weren't there. I have no recollection of those conversations. People that I've met, you know, still sometimes I'll bump into someone new and they go, yeah, we've met. And you're like, oh, fuck. It's true, though, isn't it? It's just, oh, fuck. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story. There was a situation, it was a political hustings that I'd organised at the school, and I met this woman, and I've gone, oh, hi, I'm Carmella. She went, yeah, we've met. She looked me up and down. I was like, oh, really? Where do we meet? We met in the pub. I still can't recall a memory of her, but I do now. I know exactly who she is now. Yeah, I mean, can you imagine that?
It's just I like, don't
know you're going to meet. I know you, and you're like, oh, shit, do you? Good or bad? Oh, bad, okay.
I mean, the most I didn't, because I didn't really go out, you know,
in my,
I was just staying at home with the kids. And so we would just, I'd forget the end of a film, or we'd have a row and I'd forget what the row was about. Or the best bit was, and I've said, I've told this before on the podcast, but Dale would wake up and he'd look at me and he'd apologize. Oh. I had no idea why or what for, and I'd accept it.
See, I didn't. I was the opposite. Do you know what I resorted to? This is, I feel a lot of shame for this because it never fucking worked. I'm sure if I go through my phone, I might find some. I used to leave myself notes.
Did you?
So you can still remember things at 10 o'clock and you started happening with your husband because he's been an arsehole about blah, blah, blah. Obviously it was me. I wouldn't remember that point of being sober enough to leave myself a note.
I mean, we're laughing about it, but it must have been incredibly dangerous as well.
It is hard, isn't it? And I'm sure when you might, well, I'm going to ask you whether you can relate to this, but when you're in control of children, just because you're in your house doesn't mean that you shouldn't be in control of your children in your house. And by that, I mean, things happen, accidents happen, and can you react and respond in an appropriate way? Because just because you think the children are asleep, you think that's you clocked off for the night. Well, that isn't the reality.
No, anything could happen.
Anything could happen. And I do remember, you know, Luca having croup once and having to wake up. And actually, I hadn't drank that much, but I'd drunk enough to be groggy. And me and my husband just, we hadn't had loads, but we had enough to be over the limit, and he had to go to hospital. I had to phone a freaking ambulance.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's an example where actually I wasn't smashed and he doesn't get smashed, but we'd had enough to mean we couldn't drive.
And you don't know when that day is going to be, do you? You just really don't know. You could just be a bit over the limit and that's it.
Well, you know, I think for me, you know, imagine, like, if anything had happened when I really had a lot to drink, would I have woken up? And I know this is really deep, dark stuff. And I always worry about even talking about things like this because I feel deep, deep shame. And it's not like there was ever loads of these situations. But when you sort of sit there when you're sober, you do have a very different view on things.
You do, yeah.
And, you know, also, I don't want anyone to feel shame over, you know, their parenting and their drinking, but we have to be aware. We have to be aware because, again, I do feel this has been fed to us as a society that, oh, the kids are in bed. Woo, mummy gets to have a drink. Mummy gets to have some wine. Mummy gets to have some gin. You know, it's like we've clocked off. We're not the parents anymore. But you are still responsible for your children whilst they're in your home. And I definitely found that motherhood brought less opportunities to go out and get plastered and actually way more opportunities to get smashed in the house because who sees you?
And you also have home measures and you can, you know, it's not the same, is it? You know, you can kind of drink more without realising it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then, you know, I know what you're saying. There's no shame. It's no shame on somebody who's drinking, you know, around children. It's not
it's
about
being aware,
that.
It's right. It's being aware. And I don't think as individuals, as you don't suddenly just get to the point of home drinking, but you're fed so many messages. If we're going back to the marketing, you still bloody see it. It's this whole notion rewarding ourselves after a hard day. What I realise is actually I can handle most shit, right? I can handle real hard shit. I don't fucking need a drink or a box of chocolates or a new pair of shoes to reward me for living life. We need to reevaluate how we see reward. That's a whole nother bloody topic because we're told we need a reward for everything, which is why we eat so much shit and we drink so much shit and we spend so much shit because we need to a reward for living life. You know what I mean? We can do hard shit, especially us mums. We're like super, super women. But back to the kind of point about the drinking at home, you know, we are told that I did read a report post-lockdown, which was looking at marketing trends around alcohol. And because obviously we stopped going out so much and we definitely did take alcohol into the home, it was looking at marketing and campaigns that were actually looking around the home drinking and not looking at home drinking as the cheap way of drinking, right?
Yeah.
You know, but actually looking at it as the, you know, sophisticated, glamorous way of unwinding at home. That says it all, doesn't it? To why we like this. But yeah, you know, I think the home drinking is a dangerous situation. Definitely found that was a big area of where my drinking escalated, because it's a very tricky, dangerous territory, the home drinking.
It is. So, okay, what's your second thing?
My second thing, and I'm sure quite a lot of people will be able to relate to this, is my career. And maybe not in the way that everyone would say, but for me, it was finding my voice and finding my confidence. Now, I work in events. I can honestly say my sobriety has been my biggest superpower. As we're coming out of lockdown, my industry was illegal at the time. I was out of work for some time and I got a job and I was running one of the UK's largest business awards programs. And I genuinely thought, what am I going to do when it comes to the socializing and networking? I was absolutely terrified. But what I did find was, and I have to say, I was so fortunate that, you know, my boss and good friend Sarah, I remember that I appeared in a piece in the Telegraph, and there's nothing like breaking down barriers with your new boss when you're like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm in a paper this weekend. You might want to hear, might be reading all about my checkered history. And she did read it and she messaged me and said, I read it and I just want to say, I feel so privileged to have you part of the team. And I thought, oh my God, like I never expected that. And that she instilled a lot of confidence with me. But what I did find was by being true to myself and talking about my truth when I was at events, I'm still staggered by the amount of people that go, you don't drink. Oh, well, do you mind if I ask why? Why ask why? And I'm quite happy to talk about it. And it always leads into, you know, conversations that are quite frank about their own drinking or their own experience of loved ones that have, you know, drank and had drinking problems. I have never, not in work situations, ever had any negativity around my not drinking. It is my superpower. It enables me to be open and honest, have frank conversations and break down barriers with people. And I met some incredible people through my work on the awards in particular, who I still talk to now, so influential. I mean, you're talking some of the, you know, best business minds and leaders in the country, and they're supporting you with your sobriety, or they're turning around and who would have thought they don't drink either?
Yeah.
What? You don't drink? And it's not the same reason as me. They're like, no, because, you know, I need to be on top of my A game. You're like, yeah, you've got it. I want to be on top of my A game. These are conscious decisions to not drink, because they know that in order for them to be as brilliant as they are, they need to remove barriers. And they are the ones that don't drink, eat well, sleep, do all the good things. And fuck me, they didn't have a drinking problem. And I'm still gobsmacked. And when I meet them, I'm like, really? Really? But it makes perfect sense, you know, to really, you know, when you're meeting people that don't drink as well, and for lots of different reasons. So finding my voice and finding my confidence and realizing that I can be me, and that's it, and that is enough, and people find me inspiring. It's pretty bloody amazing, you know, how something that was my biggest struggle is actually something that people find inspiring. It still blows my mind. So yeah, you know, that was a big personal revelation for me. But also what comes with not drinking is that leveling up of your game. You're not hungover. You know what the hell's going on. You are not making yourself vulnerable. And I will say this, because we don't think about this all the time. When we're drinking in social situations at work, you think it's good. And for the most part, it is. But there are situations where you are being judged.
Yeah.
And people use situations. People in work can be manipulative, and they can use these little nuggets of you when you're just thinking that you're amongst friends and you're letting your hair down. They can use these little nuggets as leverage and power over you. And it's done in such a way, it's quite, you don't really notice it's happening, but it happens a lot in work. And when you're sober, you are absolutely, you can take ownership of your action. If I make mistakes, I'm happy to hold my hands up because I know what that mistake was. I'm not shying away from confrontation or conflict because I'm scared that they might know something that I did 2 weeks ago when I blacked out. But I feel confident to go and assert myself because I have nothing to hide. I know exactly what I've done. And whether it's right or wrong, it doesn't matter because you're holding yourself true and you're holding yourself accountable and you're putting yourself out there without the fear of, what do they know that I can't remember? You know, it's been a massive game changer in work, giving up alcohol.
Oh, I've said a few things I regret, you know, work dues and things like that. And you notice the demeanor change slightly of the person. You're thinking, oh, what did I say? Because I just get loose lips. I'd remember it, though. And then I think, oh, why did I have to pass comment on that? Or, you know, why did I have to say that?
I don't know about you, but I would become very angry. So if I'd had lots of work grievances, you know, and things, tensions are building up, if I'd had a drink, they would all come out.
Yeah.
All come out and very emotional, sloppy, angry. Well, it makes me shudder thinking I used to be that frustrated ball of anger. You know,
so do you think that anger's calmed down now in sobriety? Do you think it was maybe the alcohol that was fueling it?
I was unhappy with everything. Everything feeds into one another and it becomes the endless cycle of shit. It's the only way to describe it. Yeah, I'm pretty happy. I'm very happy. You know, I do kind of think there's always things that I would like to be doing more of and achieving more of, but I'm content. I don't know, like, the power of contentment. You know, I'm happy with my day-to-day life. In amongst the day-to-day, what people would call monotony, I would just call fucking sanctuary. It's amazing. I fill my time with the things that I enjoy, my family commitments and everything else, with the people I actually like spending time with. What I've realised through sobriety is actually I'm definitely an extroverted introvert. And I need to feed both sides of me to really make me happy. And I never knew that. I was never nurturing the introvert, the one that actually finds it quite exhausting to meet new people, but equally loves meeting new people. The one that doesn't like to put makeup on all the time and go plodding around for a dog walk or go down my allotment. You know, I'm nurturing that part of me that really brings me joy. And that is the side that brings me peace too. And actually that side that I was never nurturing before I got sober, never got a look in. And it's the side that gives me the most happiness.
Wow. Yeah.
How crazy. I've got this massive diary. And as part of it, I remember when I was going back to work from having my little one, finished maternity leave, and it brought this huge planner. It was all about life and goals and stuff. I opened it up, list five things you want to achieve, list five things that make you happy. And I looked at it, held my pen over the pages, and I burst into tears because I didn't know who the hell I was anymore. I genuinely didn't. And I still don't think I do. I'm really relishing and enjoying the experience of getting to know myself, discover my new things, push myself. I love it. And I genuinely like the person that I am now. It's not often that we feel we can say we like who we are because it's like, oh gosh, she thinks, you know, she's full of herself. Bullshit. It's nothing about that. I've worked really fucking hard to like the person who is in front of, you know, who I look at in the mirror. And that is so powerful. You know, when you can go around hating what you see or not knowing who you are, it's just awful. It's a sad way of being. But I was like that for so long. I was like that for so long.
Do you think it's maybe our age group? We grew up in a really, really harsh, decade or two, couple of decades, didn't we? The 80s, 90s, 2000s. Everyone was really hard on themselves. Women had to achieve everything. Women had to have it all.
Oh, I talk about this a lot. I think we're on the same wavelength. Do you know what? I remember we'd read Cosmo, we'd read those sorts of mags. I'm trying to think what else I used to read, you know.
You have to have amazing sex life, you have to have this amazing career, this disposable income.
Have children. And what I will say is we were always told the headlines would always be, you can have it all. And I understand where this was coming from because we were going through a period of liberation. But what's happening is when you're told you can have it all, you think you have to do it all. What in actual fact I've become to realise is you can have it all, but have the things that bring you joy, right? I don't want it all. Do you know what I mean? I have the career, but I have negotiated a 4-day working week because I do want my career, but I also want other things just as importantly. And it's about looking at what are your priorities to you and have those. It's about empowering yourself to make the choice that's right for you and forget if your life's not working at the moment. Yeah, you're right. I think it was something to do with our age group. I think some women in particular, you know, like you say, this notion of having it all and this amazing sex life and this career and the family. And these are all very conflicting things. They don't often all work in tandem.
No, they don't, because if you remember, it was drink like men, but be skinny. I mean, they don't equate.
The skinny thing was interesting and kind of exactly the sort of shit we were fed. It was just around how people would dictate your weight. So if you're looking at like Britney Spears being interviewed and they're talking about her boobs, and you're looking at Victoria Beckham the minute she's had a baby and they're asking her on chat shows to get on some scales. That was our reality. For me, I have to say my eating disorder was less about being skinny and more about control, which when you're having a childhood that's quite traumatic around alcohol, you know, you'd be thinking that you'd move towards alcohol and drugs and things, you know, to kind of soothe the hurt. But actually, I was so scared of alcohol back then when in my younger self. I just didn't want to be like these experiences that I've experienced. And so you find some other way to control your life and control your situation. With my bulimia, it came around when I started trying to lose weight healthily, and I was. And as I was starting to lose weight, and I can look back and recognise I was very much nowhere near skinny at all at this point, I had a lot of friends who'd be going, you're getting too skinny. And sometimes these things are being said in a way that's concerned, but there's also times when people are saying this. Because if we're feeling vulnerable about ourselves, we want to kind of make sure that bringing people back in, same with alcohol, right? So, you know, should you be getting that skinny? I think you're losing too much weight. You know, it's like, let's all keep us in the same area. So I thought I can go out and I can go out with my mates and I'll eat exactly what they are eating. So I won't look at my calories. I won't be on my diet plan. I'll eat what they're eating. Then I'll make myself sick and they won't know any difference. So I'll still be achieving the goal I've set myself of losing a little bit of weight whilst keeping everyone else happy. And then that is exactly the moment I can pinpoint when my bulimia started. And to kind of bring it back round to the correlation between some fat experience and, say, alcohol is how, you know, if you've got friends that aren't ready to change their relationship with alcohol and actually they're like, no, come on, you're not that bad.
You're fine.
You have a drink, you're fine. It's fucking ain't about you and what you want. It's about them. Yeah. And that's when you always have to be thinking to yourself, what do I want? Because in actual fact, if I would have just listened to myself, I wanted to feel good at that particular point. I liked going to my exercise classes and I wasn't eating healthy. I liked being healthier. You know, I was in that health mode. That wanting to please other people created something that completely took over my late teens and early 20s. It was absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
And that just one thing of not being true to yourself and listening and trying to bend yourself to please others was just, yeah.
What's your third thing then?
I'm going to say self-discovery. And I know this is kind of was touched on, but it does feed in. And knowing who you are or who you are becoming or where you are now and being and really understanding what you like and don't like and having that strength of conviction and that strength to realise that actually, if I really want something, I can do it. Sobriety gave me that. You know, sorry, I'm getting emotional. I have to say, for years, I just generally thought I was, well, you know, I was unreliable. And I remember for years, I would set myself New Year's resolution, and that New Year's resolution would be consistency, because I couldn't do anything consistently. I couldn't stay happy consistently. You know, I couldn't pursue anything with any consistency. And I just really felt like I just wanted to achieve one thing and do it right and do it well. And for years, I thought that the only way I would get sober would be through other people. And, you know, I realized there is no one, there was no one that could ever take me from where I was to where I am now. There's people that can help you and they can hold you and they can lift you and they can advise you and they can inspire you. But ultimately, you have the power to do the things you really want to do. And I don't know where along the line I'd started believing that I didn't have the power to do those things, but I lost it. And I always thought that, you know, there was something broken or wrong with me. You know, the reality is that one day I woke up and I really, really not wanted to not drink again. That was it. And I moved all the excuses and bullshit and I just went for it. And it was fucking hard. It was for me because I just didn't know where to go. But I found the route. I found the direction. And each day I just tried and I set myself, you know, that view, and I got there. And to know that that was me, that was no one else that ultimately did that, I can't tell you how empowering that is, because when you realise that you can do it in one area of your life, you realise if you really want it, you can do it in any area of your life. And I can't tell you how incredible that feeling is that you are in control. And I'd been looking for control for so long. And actually, the ultimate control that, you know, I had a glimmer of in an eating disorder, actually I found in sobriety. And I can't tell you that is like one of the biggest things that it's given me. It's given me myself. And I genuinely like who I am now.
Well, I think you're great. And I think the fact that you can see that is amazing.
Sorry, I'm getting proper emotion. But it's true. You know, you don't get many opportunities to look back and see how far you've come. You know,
yeah.
You don't really sometimes take as much stock to realise just how far you've come. And every time I do, it just astounds me. You know, and it's just an incredible feeling just knowing who I am now.
Thank you so much for joining me. It has been brilliant and it's just so lovely to be able to talk to you after all this time watching you.
Oh, absolutely. Likewise. Thank you so much for having me. Honestly, it really means a lot to be invited. So thank you for letting me to take myself back and kind of relive some of it. It's been really amazing.
Thank you so much to Carmela for taking the time to talk to me today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And if you'd like to connect or find out more about Carmela or myself, you'll find the links to our Instagram accounts in the show notes. And of course, you can head to louisaevans.com if you'd like to find out more about my story. You'll find a link to my audiobook there. And you'll also be able to find out how you could work with me if you'd like some support. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a good day, and I'll catch you next time.